We're back. It is 6 minutes after 12 o'clock right now on a Thursday, and we got two of the most interesting guys you'd ever want to meet. They're right here in the studio. Yeah, I'm talking to you. Man,
I'm talking to Chris. And I kept looking behind
I'm looking
you
around. Yeah, you bet.
I thought
man.
Pat said our show was today.
Well, thanks for coming in again. It is a Thursday. The last Thursday of the month is when we like to have you guys in and talk about some individual or some movement in church history. You teach a class at Pacific Bible College. You've read stacks and stacks of books and magazines on church history.
Can't even get in the door anymore.
Nope. It's an so insight many into what kind of lives they have. But you're here again to talk about another interesting individual in our family tree.
Oh, we sure are, Pat. You know, we pour through and we look through, and every year that we study history, we find new little gems that are worthy of taking out and polishing up and taking a close look at. And Joan is certainly one of those. You know, just for fun, let's paint the picture so everybody's got an idea. We all know it's in France here in Europe. We're back in the 1400s. Now, we're just coming out from under the Black Death, the plague that wiped out almost half of the population of Europe, time when you had the Babylonian captivity in the church, where you have three popes running around at the same time. It's very politicized, very cynical. This is when Wycliffe is writing his translations of the Bible into English. Jan Hus has just been burned at the stake, and Thomas a Kempis is writing Imitation of Christ. You know, and you got what is the Hundred Years' War going on. That sounds like a load of fun, doesn't it?
And it's so interesting because it lasted more than 100 years.
It did last more than 100 years. This is, when we're teaching classes, as a matter of fact, Pat, we refer to this as the real Dark Age, is the this period of the 1300s and the early 1400s. Well, basically, set against this, let me explain. The Hundred Years' War, this is the 32nd distillation of the Hundred Years' War. What most people don't realize is everybody remembers the Battle of Hastings, 1066. Right. Norman the Conqueror comes over, takes over England. Basically, what this means is England and France.
William
both
the Conqueror, he was a Norman.
Exactly. Norman. Okay, basically, his ancestors were Vikings. Actually, not even that far away. Basically, England and France at this time had French kings. That's what we're boiling down to. And England is not the little island that we think of, you know, Britain, Scotland, and Ireland. It feeds off over into its northern France, parts of the southern France coast. I mean, basically, if we had a big map and you're looking at the blue state, red state thing, you know, England is this giant red state that is crawling all over half of France.
It's on the continent.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And they thought that this is our kingdom. You know, it's a French king, Henry V. He's half French. And this is part of England, you know, and so that's what they're struggling about.
There's a tunnel right there under the English Channel that connects the two of them.
I was going to say, and if Joan hadn't put things right, think of the billions of dollars we'd have to spend reprinting our atlases and maps. It'd be
Absolutely.
A national disaster, I'm telling you. Well, anyway, okay, we've got the story there. 100 years, England and France are just toe-to-toe. They're just slugging it out, and it's awful. I mean, picture the worst parts of Lord of the Rings, you know. I mean, you know, Helm's Deep and Before the White City. It's, okay, I don't think they had orcs and goblins, but pretty much everything else was up to snuff.
Well, most certainly. And you know, the English had their part of France, and funny thing, the French people kind of wanted to have that back.
You know, it's funny, how about that?
And it caused a bit of a conflict.
Well, didn't they actually, wasn't it actually because the English didn't have any good vineyards?
Well, you know, there are some people that have actually surmised because of the fact that financially, the north of France was an incredible burden on England anyway to maintain that as part of their kingdom, but that they weren't going to give that up, mm-hmm. frankly, because English wine is not known anywhere, but French wine is, and that the kings of England did not want to readily give up that source of good French
which
wine.
Which just goes to show you.
Really?
Well, that's a distinct possibility that was part of the big equation.
Now, in the midst of all this, fellas, I want you to picture the perfect, sweet 17-year-old country girl.
In your church.
Now, I'm talking about the one that, you know, she always shows up, you know, at the meet you at the pole. She wears the promise ring. You know, she's going to keep herself. She babysits. She takes meals on wheels to the sick and elderly. You know, the youth pastor brags about her at every staff meeting. You
that's
know,
right.
That's a girl at your church that you pray to the Lord.
That your nephew is going to marry
your nephew or your son gets to marry
Definitely.
This girl. That's the one you want. I mean, she's the creme de la creme, as they say. Well, that's Joan. As a matter of fact, just for fun, if you had to sum up who Joan is to the French people, basically, for an equivalent for us would be somebody like Abraham Lincoln, you know, common beginnings, humble background.
A uniter, not a divider.
A riser to save the nation. You'd even have to kind of throw in a little Davy Crockett and a little Ben Franklin in there, too, you know.
Absolutely.
Just to get the coast. Well, that's
she
Joan.
She was the right person at the right place for the right war.
I like your thinking on that.
It just came to me.
I mean, but who could have guessed? What, a teenage girl?
Just a little peasant girl.
Who could have guessed? And that is, you know, really, she is the patron saint of France and is one of their great patriotic figures. And just to kind of focus and hone in now on her life, she was born in January of 1412. So we've just marked her birthday. And she was born in a sleepy little medieval village called Domremy, which is out in eastern France. And the people out there live like, you know, your typical idea of the way people lived in the Middle Ages. People were living off the land. They were tied to the land. And her family was fairly prosperous. They were not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but they were not in dirt poverty. Her father was they found in town records. Her father was in the government, possibly the mayor of Domremy at one point in time, and they had a large family farm and a nice home. And Joan herself grew up like a typical young girl in eastern France. She sat at her mom's knees, learned how to sew, how to spin wool. She tended her father's sheep. Just a very, very typical childhood. Well-liked in town, was, as Matthew had mentioned, you know, constantly active in the church and attending church services all the time, involved in charitable activities. And one of the things, though, that Joan had grown up with, as we've mentioned, this Hundred Years' War, is that she had grown up in the constant reality of war. And according to historian Will Durant, the mindset of the people of France was the fact that they really did believe the English people were devils. And they actually thought maybe that they had actual tails and they hid them in their long coats. And so there was quite a negative a view of the English. There's also, interestingly, and this is in a history of France, a story of a prophecy that was floating around the French countryside that someday a young virgin girl was going to deliver them from this siege of Satan against their country. Very interesting thing, because it was a prophecy, not coming out of the church, but something, you know, that happens in the peasant culture of that country. Well, the years now, we jump to 1424. Joan of Arc is 13 years old. And so she's a nubile girl now, and she has her very first experience. And what she tells us is that she sees a bright light that flashes over her head. She's out in the woods, and she hears a voice speak to her. And the voice tells her that she needs to go and be an obedient child and needs to go off into church, which sort of begs the question, how much more obedient and good can you be? I mean, here's somebody who's very pious already, goes to church all the time. You know, how much more good can you be? But I guess if you're hearing a heavenly and unearthly voice speaking to you, you obey that, and that's certainly what...
It was just the Archangel Michael protecting his investment.
Exactly.
Okay.
And over the next couple years, Joan claims to have further visitations. Apparently that first voice she heard eventually identifies himself as the Archangel Michael. And she has further visitations by two other well-known saints in her part of the world, Catherine of Alexandria and another lady by the name of Margaret of Antioch. And there's some very interesting connections with these people. First of all, Margaret of Antioch was a virgin who was martyred because of false accusations made against her. As a matter of fact, she is the patron saint of those who are falsely accused.
Hmm.
Then you have Catherine, who was a very virtuous woman who came to faith in Christ because of a vision she saw. And then, of course, you have Michael the Archangel, who is known to be the one who led the battle against the forces of Lucifer when he rebels in heaven. So here you have these three saints who in reality actually are almost biographical representations of the very life and the very story of Joan of Arc. Hmm. She was a virgin. She was falsely accused. She had visions. She was very pious, and she was leading, you know, in the battle against Satan. And it's just very interesting that we have...
I don't know where he finds this stuff. He never ceases to amaze me.
The other connection, of course, is that all three of these people, these personages, are represented in the statuary of the church in Domremy. In her hometown. They had a little cathedral there that had all sorts of statuary, and all three of these people are represented there, and they come to her, and we hear later on in her trial that they all spoke perfect French to her, which, you know, makes perfect sense to me, that, you know, whatever language you speak in, God speaks your language. He knows, you know, so he's going to be able to speak to you. And then also, she says they're beautiful in appearance, and they smell beautiful, which I thought was a phenomenal thing, that somehow or another in these visions she also had a sense of smell associated with them, that it was extremely beautiful instead of the, you know, the diabolic pit of hell and the sulfur and everything. She has a beautiful thing.
Well, now, don't they start getting a little bit more pointed about what they'd like her to
do,
pointed, though?
And, you know, the first they start talking to her, and they talk to her about her piety, they talk to her about maintaining her chastity, but eventually they begin speaking to her about her mission to save France, and, you know, putting ourselves in her shoes, you know, if I were, you know, 16 or 17, and I was having voices telling me I needed to save the United States of America, I'd need a couple years warning to work up to that. You know? I wouldn't just jump right on that. So that the voices do get more pointed, though, that she has a mission bigger than just being pious and maintaining her chastity, but rather she has a mission to save herself, save her own country. And by 1428, Joan's now about 18 years old. She's described as a handsome and healthy girl with dark hair and a smiling face and a very quiet disposition. And by this point in the story, hearkening back to the war and everything, France is basically toast. Okay, there's one central city. Paris is is basically belongs to the English now, and there's the central city of Orléans, where we get New Orleans from, or how do you say that in
English? Nolens.
Nolens, where we get Orléans. That is a central city in France, and basically this is being sieged by the English, and if it falls, more than likely the rest of France is going to completely become an English property.
For the first time she started talking about this,
most
did they?
Certainly. No, they,
oh,
you know.
Was, yeah.
Didn't she go to the policeman in the next village, and
he listens to it, and he says, you know, I think you need to go home and have a spanking by your father, I believe is
But she's not put off by that. He actually sends her packing home, and she's not put off. She actually goes back. It's only 20 miles, but it's the main town in her neighborhood. And she hangs out and just insists, sits in his office, won't leave. And finally, after a month or two of this, he's starting to think, I don't want to get in trouble in case, you know, God really is speaking to this little girl. So he gets out about a half dozen of his soldiers, and he sends them, it must be 200-300 miles, down to where the prince or the Dauphine is hiding. Well, he's not hiding, but he's trying not to be killed or captured.
Right.
He's about 150 miles south of Paris, a little town, don't you remember the name? Chinon. I need to tell you that I have forbidden Christopher to speak more than 12 authentic French place names or proper nouns, and in retaliation, he has forbidden me to speak about any details of strategic or tactical importance when discussing military maneuvers. It's a relationship
that's
that works, okay?
Well.
Yeah, absolutely. So she finally gets down there to Chinon, where the king is, or the prince,
and he hides himself.
You know, his messengers have come ahead and say, hey, look, we got this wacko chick that is out in the foyer, and she says she's come from God to save you in France. Okay, King? And, you know, all his advisors are rolling their eyes and clucking, and they're saying, I don't know. So he hides himself. He disguises himself as like a page boy.
Kind of like the Wizard of Oz does, where he acts as the doorman when Dorothy comes. It's exactly the same idea.
And he's hiding off to the side. She and they usher her into the throne room. She doesn't even blink. She just turns right towards him and salutes him and says, Your Majesty. And says hello. Well, that blows everybody away because she's a little country girl, never seen him before. So she's got their attention immediately. Now she starts talking about, you know, you really need to relieve the siege of Orléans or we are toast. You know, they'll take the second half of the country. And she wears him down, just like she did the policeman back in her old village. And finally, even though some of his counselors are still grumbling, they send her down to the priests down at the convent, and the nuns examine her. Okay, she's a virgin, she's a good Catholic girl. We think she's on the level, King. So he gives her a sword, he gives her a banner, and he gives her a couple troops and sends her off to the Battle of Orléans, and it was about 40 miles up the river. And she gets there, rallies the troops, kicks the living starlights. I'm having to be real careful about selecting my adjectives here.
Too bad you didn't know more French. See, if you knew French.
For the most magnifique. Anyway, leave it to say that Orléans is a stunning defeat for the English. They were in charge, they were in superior strength and numbers and position, and they just got their clocks cleaned. Not only that, Joan and her guys boot them out of Orléans, and then for the next week, harry the English over the fields north of Orléans and kill like 6,000 English. The English guys are screaming. They're running. It's the worst retreat they've experienced in ever, and they just don't know what to do. And everybody's cheering, and Joan comes back to Orléans, and she just pushes ahead to the next big town up the river and takes that one, you know, and then pushes on up the river, takes that one, and she's just marching across the middle of France, you know, on the south side of Paris, just taking town after town. Well, within months, she's talked the king, the prince, into coming with her. And she says, the next town is Reims, which is really the spiritual center
of France at the time.
And if she does this, then he will be able to be crowned in their cathedral. And that is the...
Really rallies the French.
It's like the Canterbury for the English. I mean, if you're crowned anywhere else, you're not really the king. You know, so by taking Reims and taking the king with her, that will really justify his claim to take over the whole country. So he's terrified, but he's okay. You've got all this. You're winning all these victories. I guess we'll go with you. They get to Reims, and there's not even a battle. The English have departed. The people open the gates. In they march. The king is coronated. He's crowned. He is now Charles the VII. And everything that should happily end there. And if Joan had gone back to her village, probably it would have ended happily there. But I'm afraid things take a bad turn.
She listened, you know. She actually, by this point, has stopped hearing her heavenly instructions. And she has some deep misgivings about continuing on. It's like, okay, mission accomplished. I've done what I was told to do.
But they won't let her go.
Yeah, she basically gets pressured and talked into continuing to accompany the military in these battles.
Why lose a big asset like this? Yeah. I mean, you know, Joan, you know what we really need is for you to take over Paris now.
And it's always the case. I mean, if you look at anybody's undoing, it's always taking something and going beyond what God told you to do.
It's like Michael Jordan retiring three times in a row
exactly,
and having to come back, you know. Well, she goes to Paris. She doesn't do well. There's several defeats. She's wounded a couple times. And the horrible thing is, even though the king really loves her, many of the guys in his staff they won't send the proper troops. They won't supply the troops.
They don't like her.
Yeah, you know, they don't stand a chance, really. I mean, it's going to take a miracle upon a miracle for her to do anything good again. So finally, she is captured in a little town 30 miles north of Paris, Compiègne, and taken prisoner by the English. And, boy, the king is unhappy, but there's not too much he can do.
He tries to negotiate through back channels, but that is never...
They're not buying it.
That never bears fruit. And basically, she gets sold for about $80,000 in today's currency. And anyway, early the next year, she endures a four-month trial for heresy and for witchcraft.
Oh, and it was in England now.
No, this is in France. Rouen, which was the almost kind of like the last toehold of the British on the. It's almost near the English Channel, and it was kind of like she was tried on French soil. But
it's like
it
in
was,
Normandy.
It was on their grounds with English clergy, and of course they had it ratified by the University of Paris, which was also pro-English at the time.
So it was a really fair trial. You know
yes.
what I mean?
Well, and wasn't Philip of Burgundy involved in this?
Oh yeah.
There's all kinds of negotiations, as there always says. You know, backdoor. Well, if you give me this, yeah, and Jones.
Oh, it was bad.
She became a pawn in a much bigger game than she realized she was in. But she was interrogated about her visions, and in the end, they were all found to be false and diabolical. And they threatened her with burning at the stake unless, of course, she planned on a full retraction. And naturally, of course, they had it all written up for her. All she had to do was sign on the bottom line that she had retracted and that
she wasn't sent from God.
All this was completely false. And under fear, basically under the fear and under the brutality of her imprisonment, she caved in and she was very afraid and she did sign. But there were those within that group of people who were against her that basically wanted her dead no matter what. It was like, you know, it doesn't matter. We want this gal. She's too powerful with the French. They're always going to be a problem if they have her. And so what they did was they made as one of her conditions that she could not dress in her men's warrior outfit anymore, which that's what she dressed in when she went in the battlefield. She had to dress in female dress, wear a dress and everything. And they put her back in her prison cell because she also had to suffer through life imprisonment.
And they just conveniently leave an entire wardrobe of men's clothing right there in the
right
cell
there.
With her.
And she, probably not temptation, probably just out of fear because she had more protection against any sort of jailhouse shenanigans, shall we say,
you know,
going on there.
This actually,
she puts this male outfit on.
This is worth an explanation.
Yes.
Men's clothing is full of hooks and buttons. I mean, it's really hard to get on and off. So if a young lady trying to protect her virtue in a prison full of nasty guards and ugly people, you know, if you're wearing a dress, you're out of luck. But if you've got something that takes a half an hour to get in and out of, you stand a chance of holding on to your virginity. And that's what she did, by golly.
And they knew it. That's it. She's a relapsed heretic.
A relapsed heretic.
She's
burner!
She's a relapsed heretic. And basically what happens is they take her and burn her at the stake.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that's the story. She was quite frightened by this and forgave her accusers. And, you know, as many of the narratives point out, you know, many left the scene realizing at the time that they had done a grievous evil.
Sure.
That they had burned a saint.
Oh, the troops, the English troops around the stake were weeping because she's calling out to God to forgive them. And
I believe her executioner felt like he was pretty much damned.
Oh my, the people,
it was pretty.
They were terrified. They went to their priest saying, "Oh, that's it. We're ruined. We've burned a holy person. We're done. We're going to hell."
So she dies, is burned to the stake. Her ashes are thrown in the Seine River. And within a few years, the English are completely driven out of France, and they have to go back to their island, and the French have their independence again. And King Charles VII orders a new trial, what they call the trial of rehabilitation for...
That's 11.
I'm almost there. And the official trial conducted by the church was held with her mother and her brothers to reestablish their family's good name and her good name. And as 6 years, they actually had a six-year investigation into Joan of Arc. And at the end of it, they found that she was innocent of heresy and wrongly executed, and therefore they declared her a martyr. And in recent times, believe it or not, this is very recent, historically speaking, Pat.
Yeah.
In the 18th century, just before the start of the Civil War in the U.S., she was nominated by the Pope for beatification. And then in the 1920s, in the 20th century, she actually achieved the status of what we would call a saint.
Over the years, even the English agree that was a mistake. We'd never do that again. She was righteous.
So we have you know, just ending the show, we have a couple thoughts on this.
Well, you can go three ways.
There's some trains of thought on this, and what we mean about trains of thought is is this real? You know, is this an authentic thing that Joan of Arc experienced? And one of the popular trains of thought, of course, is the psychological thing. A couple of years ago, a lot of people don't realize this, but in Maryland, in United States, in Maryland, they held 2 years ago a trial for Joan of Arc. They actually had a real judge. They had real lawyers. They brought the evidence in and they looked at the evidence. And basically, Joan got off the hook because of the fact that they said she was delusional, that she had psychological problems, was delusional, and therefore
could totemic symbol. That,
exactly, an existential moment that she was having there. But the problem with this is, and if any of you have dealt with this in your family or not, I know that in my ministry I've dealt with people that are very delusional, and I have done visitations of people that are hospitalized for their delusions. And one of the things that's very common with people who are delusional is reality does not match their reality. But what can you say about Joan of Arc, who was told to go do this, and all this comes true? And comes true in exactly the fashion that she had said it was and said the voices are given to her. So the delusion falls apart.
No, really, yeah, the delusional thing doesn't work. And the whole thing of she was accused of demonic possession, you know, I'm sorry, it just seems to me there's an awful lot of glory to God floating around here for this to be a case of demonic possession. It's another case where if you examine the fruit of the life of a saint, you know, this is, you've got to say, my golly, this is something that came from God. You know, look at the fruit.
There you go. I'm sorry. It's all that fruit thing going on. Examining the fruit.
I don't know what I was thinking.
But probably not very diabolical, which then leaves maybe a third idea on this, and that is that what happened really was fairly authentic.
Do you mean that the supernatural was actually involved?
Well, you know, it's quite interesting because this is not without biblical precedent. When you think about the Old Testament story of Deborah and Barak, she was a prophetess raised up by God in a time of national emergency in Israel. Was given directives by God and carried it out to the glory of God, and by dinghies they won the war. And it's certainly in line with the way that God speaks with us. We have plenty of examples in Scripture of people that are spoken to with just intuitive thoughts. Sometimes people actually see visions. Sometimes they see symbols in dreams. All these are biblical. The problem is that some of us never expect anything like that to happen.
Haven't personally experienced it, perhaps, and are amazingly never disappointed.
Because we don't expect things like that. And yet the Bible shows us that these things are very authentic. And I think that we should definitely believe the story of Joan of Arc as being something very authentic and of true prophecy.
Which just proves that it's the latest, history is just the latest chapter in the book of Acts. You know, what the Bible says continues in history. And Joan is just a little peasant girl that stepped up to the plate because God told her to and hit a home run.
And would that another Joan of Arc would rise up in our midst.
Amen.
In the time we live in. So, there's the story, Pat.
Fascinating. Thank you, guys. Yeah, I'm right on there with you. Great research. Very interesting. Joan of Arc, Matt McAuliffe and Chris White here today. And they're going to be back in a month doing Francis Schaeffer,
I believe.
Way to go. Man, well, we could, well, better not get started there. But anyway, thanks for that again, guys. We have Ravi Zacharias coming up here in about 10 minutes. And, of course, we have Focus on Faith. Patrick Doyle will be in at 1 o'clock. Right now, it's time for Manage Your Money. Today's